Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. If you've been listening to this podcast or are new to it, I thank you very much. I would also appreciate if you took a moment and followed it on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. We have covered many aspects to getting published, whether writer or illustrator. Today, we will be discussing something that has not been covered in the 2 years of the podcast, how to present yourself, and what makes a good bio, and how important is your headshot, simple tools to promote yourself. Today's guest is Inzondi, also known as Ace Antonio Hall. Inzondi is an American urban fantasy and horror writer. His novel, Owari Mosaic, won the Bram Stoker Award for Superior Achievement and Young Adult Fiction. Inzondi is a former director of education for NYC Schools and the Sylvan Learning Center. I initially met Inzondi through the Greater Los Angeles Writers Society, one of the largest writing societies in California, when he, as vice president, made a presentation on the 80th anniversary of L. Ron Hubbard as a professional author back in 2014. Welcome, Inzondi.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've been trying to do this, I think, since World Fantasy 2 years ago. We didn't have it last year, but yeah, it was. So finally, we're getting this together. So this is great.
A little thing called life kind of got in the way of that, but we're back on track now.
That's great. That's great. So first off, you're both a stand-in and a writer. So after describing what a stand-in actually is, how do you juggle these two professions?
Yeah, you know, even before I answer that, you know, I used to teach school. So I taught school in New York for somewhere around 11 years. And then 2 years, I was at the Sylvan Learning Center as a director. So one of the things that I used to always tell my students was whatever passion or whatever career that you go into, you have to have a passion, an insane passion for what you want to do. And I always give the example of Michelangelo and what it took to paint the Sistine Chapel. You know, I said for someone to be on a ladder and leaning backwards, and maybe he had some helpers, but to finish that project took such an overwhelming amount of focus that the ordinary person wouldn't do it. You know, they'd do it for a few hours and say, you know, I say, screw this. I can't, you know, I can't do this. My back hurts. And so that's kind of what I believe it takes, or what it took for me to be able to be on, you know, I'm writing my fourth novel now, and to have published the novels that I have, was this insane obsession to just get it done no matter what. Like, it was a job. And so how I juggled the two, I'm a stand-in. So a stand-in, I work for a variety of different television and theatrical film productions. I have worked over the years, anywhere from Happy Endings to How to Get Away with Murder. I did that whole run starring Viola Davis. And a stand-in, I say is basically a stuntman, but I don't do the stunts. We basically go over the rehearsals and everything that the lighting and camera department needs to go over before the actor stands in and does the scene. So that's what a stand-in is. We're a stand-in actor. And so we have a lot of downtime. We may do that. Actually, when they start a scene, it may take about an hour to 2 hours to get the scene set up. And there are many, 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 many setups. Just to give an example, that's that incredible Psycho, the shower scene in Psycho. Yeah. Just the shower scene alone was somewhere around over 50 setups. Just for that scene, 50 setups. And so there are a lot of different setups, and some of them are quick. So I can sit down for a minute, sometimes 2 minutes, or for an hour to 2 hours and get my writing done. And a lot of people say, I can't do that. Get up and get down, get up and get down, and stay focused. But I think about it, you know, I always think of Michelangelo. I have to get it done. So that's kind of how I had to, you know, had to juggle it. And the insane part was when I wrote my first novel, anyone who knows me back then, I wasn't a mother with kids. I get that. But I turned my phone off and I was in Starbucks on the weekends from 5 a.m. when it opened right there on Shoop and in Woodland Hills, California, till it closed at 11 p.m. My back was hurting. But I was there the whole time writing and focused on my writing. Didn't answer my phone, didn't look at my phone, and I had a few rules, couldn't play games. You know, I had to write. So it was that insane, you know, obsession that I had to get it done that's helped me to stay focused and be pretty consistent with my writing.
Wow, that's impressive.
Thanks.
So what inspired you to become a writer in the first place?
Ooh, that's a tricky question. To not sound, to use the word again, insane, you know, the characters talk to me. So, and what I mean by that is, in my sleep, I'll have a story idea or an idea for a scene. And when I'm driving, and it's like, I guess because of all the different experiences that I've had, I just hear the scene in my head and I can't not hear it or unhear it, and I have to write it down. And so, you know, a lot of those ideas come like that. And, you know, even the simplest thing, like sometimes if I go down the wrong street, I look at the name of the street and somehow that inspires me to, you know, somehow put that in my book. So
that's, so when did you start writing? Were you like, was it something you were like 4 years old and you took your crayons and wrote your first story on your bedroom wall, or how'd you get started?
Pretty close. I guess my father was one of my biggest inspirations, Chris Asaman, DC Hall. He passed away in 2006, but he was a artist connoisseur. He was a writer. He penned some of the classic jazz songs, So What by Miles Davis. He did the words to that, sung by Eddie Jefferson. He did a few songs. And he also created the first black superhero, published it, not just created it, but it was published in 1963, which was actually 3 years before Black Panther. And so I believe all of that kind of inspired me at a young age. I used to kind of color, like you say, use crayons and draw King Kong and Godzilla comics of my own. And then I established my own little superheroes. And I think that's how I started storytelling.
Wow. So that has been a life journey for you.
Yep, absolutely.
So now, you know, like I mentioned in the intro, you won the Bram Stoker Award for Owari Mosaic with your pen name Nzondi. So first of all, are all your books published under that name, Nzondi, or do any of them get published under Ace Antonio Hall?
Yeah, when I first started out, you know, I published under my stage name. My first name is actually Acemandese, Acemandese, and I'm named after a king who laid down the first stellar systems, King of Kush, Africa, who laid down the first stellar systems. And so I kind of shortened that to Ace and Antonio Hall. Antonio was my Spanish name in high school. And so those books like The Confessions of Silver Slasher and my nonfiction book, Lord of the Flies, you know, it's Fitness for Writers. Those books were written under the name Ace Antonio Hall. And, you know, after my father died, I decided that I wanted to present myself in a more, brand myself closer to my roots and my culture with my African name. So I started using my middle name, Nzondi. And, you know, I think there's a power in names. And just like that, you know, I won the Bram Stoker. I still can't believe it. I mean, it wasn't just the name that did it, but I do believe that, you know, a lot of things has to do with the whole chemistry of how it's made and made up. So, that's Nzondi's use on, I will use that on the rest of my projects from now on.
Okay. So now this book that you wrote, it's a near future post-apocalyptic story. It takes place in Ghana. And so how'd you conceive this story? What was your inspiration? It's definitely, chilling, you know, looking at, cause it's the near future. It's a post-apocalyptic near future, where the world has destroyed itself through atomic proliferation that just kind of went crazy. So how'd that develop in your...
John, you're not even going to believe how it developed. You're not going to believe it.
Okay, I'm listening. So, I'm sitting down.
So for, I don't know how long, for the longest time, I have been an avid fan, just a huge fan of Jack Klugman. And he had a show called Quincy M.E., sure. Medical Exam.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. One of my favorite of all favorite television shows. And that part of that inspired me to write this novel, which is a lot of people call a medical procedural.
Right.
That influenced me, as well as one night I watched Sherlock Holmes, The Hound of Baskerville, mm-hmm. maybe for the third or fourth time. And immediately it inspired me to write Owari Mosaic.
The Hounds of Baskerville to Owari Mosaic.
Yeah.
From London, London to Ghana. Okay, good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if The Strain and Veronica Mars had a baby and named it Altered Carbon, Owari Mosaic would be Altered Carbon's first cousin. You know,
yeah.
All of those things influenced me.
So the fact that you do like, I always have a lot of questions. So anytime I interview an author that specializes in horror or dark fantasy. So yeah. What, because you're like a real chipper guy. So I've got this fixed idea about, you know, dark fantasy and horror, you know, being the opposite of chipper. So,
right.
How does that work?
In my life, I have noticed that, and it's just in a few, you know, the few acquaintances that I've met, I've noticed that a lot of comedians that I've met, especially those that are very popular, have very dark. They were very dark people. And yet they would stand on stage and make the entire world laugh. I'm that kind of prototype. You know, I've had a lot of distress and pain and tragedies in my life, you know, from when I was 19 years old and got married. And 5 days after I got married, you know, my wife died in a car accident, you know, from that to, you know, just so many different tragedies in my life that the choice is either to let that continue to make me stay dark or to be very chipper. And I choose to be very chipper, to be very positive. However, in writing, I've learned to tap into that darkness and through that to be able to express myself. And in a way, it's very therapeutic at the same time. You know, it's just something that is part of my DNA now.
Okay, I get it. That makes sense. Because mm-hmm. these characters in your novel, I mean, the whole scenario, the whole setting is after Ghana has been everything's been destroyed, but its setting is there, and you don't really know what's happening elsewhere because a lot of that technology is gone, except for this one girl who has this implant with this game that evidently nobody else knows about except for this one other inspector. And it's just how that goes on. And
John's been reading my book. I love it.
Yeah. No, I was fascinated after you told me about it. So I wanted to read. And so just how it does, but it's so gritty on your description of the lifestyle of the people there, you know, and just, have you been there before? Have you actually been to Ghana or did you grow up there before you came to the United States or how?
Woo, you just hit, woo. Okay, so one of the things, John, when I was a teacher that really crinkled my eyebrows was when I read in the textbooks to my English teacher, I mean to my English students, that that I was to tell my students to write what they know. Okay, so I taught at IS 231 in Springfield Garden, Queens, and most of my students, what they knew were, bad marriages, streets, gangs, poverty. I didn't want them to write about that. I said, you guys can write about anything. You can write about Star Wars. You can write about two old Italian people who fell in love. You can write about anything. The key is you have to kind of put a little attention to the research it involves and, you know, make sure it's as accurate as possible. And so that's kind of what I did. So I've never been to Ghana, never been to Africa. but the imagination was there and the fascination with that culture was there. So I had to study it and make sure that it was as accurate as possible, yet still make it imaginative. So that's what I did.
I get it. Yeah, because it was just like, wow, it totally puts you into that scene and that environment. And it's obviously in the future, so you can see it's definitely decayed. Now, in that story, it's almost like there's the definite political overtones and the various isms, sociological isms that are addressed in there. Is that the intention of that? Are you trying to like provide, like, if we keep going in a certain direction, this could be the outcome, or this, what happens when you have this type of an ism as the prevailing socioeconomic policy? Or are you just trying to tell a story about this girl that's trying to get on in life and this is what's happening?
I believe that, I can't remember who told me this. It may have been my mentor, Robert J. Sawyer, who did Flash Forward and the WWW series and many other wonderful
nonfiction books. Good friend.
I think it was him. I'm not sure. But, we write a story, but every author who really writes a story has like this message that they kind of want to send as an undertone. And, it's really sometimes when you look deep into it, what the book is all about, what is the book about? And so it kind of was just my viewpoint on politics and how politics could affect an entire world or destroy an entire world.
Right.
And then the effects of how people, the emotional effects of how people can, how they live throughout that, that turmoil or that devastation, because we have tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of stories that have post-apocalyptic, that are post-apocalyptic stories, but some of them don't really go deep into the effects of how emotionally of how it, deals with how the characters deal with that.
Right.
So I kind of wanted to do that with that book.
Yeah, but a lot of times post-apocalyptic isn't near future. It's like, you just set it far enough in the future so that you're like, you're safe. But you're like, this is what, in 2026 or 2046?
I think it was 2025. Yeah, if 3 years ago you would have told me that I would have had to be at work for 12, 13 hours a day with a mask on, I would have laughed at you.
Fair enough.
Or that the entire world was affected in the way that it has been with the millions of deaths that we've had. I would not have believed if you'd have told me 3 years ago that something as devastating as like the bubonic plague would affect us. I just would have thought we, would find a way to get around that. But here we are. So, yeah.
Point made. Okay, good. Okay. So this first game goes to Ace Antonio Hall, otherwise known as Nzondi. So now when we first met, you were a vice president for the Greater Los Angeles Writers Society. Can you discuss what that is and what it can do for an aspiring writer or an accomplished writer?
Yeah, so around 2008, I just was frustrated as a creative. And what I mean by creative is a lot of people who write or who are, who are creative, they delve in a lot of different things. My father used to always say, Jack of trades, master of none. And I was that guy, I was master of none. I was singing rock music, producing music. I played on New Kids on the Block, Dirty Dog. I produced Inner City back in the day. I was trying to be a punk singer and, I was writing poetry and writing novels and trying to act and trying to direct. It was just too many things. I wasn't focused. And, 2008, I decided that's it. I know I've had a great education, but I just want to focus on writing. So I went to my first writing event. I looked up online. What do I do? Where can I go? And I went to, I don't even think they have it anymore, but the West Hollywood Book Fair in 2008. There were three and crucial entities that I was introduced that brought me to where I am today. The first two writers that I ever met was Alexander Sokolov, which if anyone is just now writing or starting to write or want to write brilliant, you should look Alexandra Sokolov up. You should take her writing courses. She has a phenomenal book about writing that kind of bounces off of Christopher Vogler's books on writing. And I met Heather Graham, not the actress, but the phenomenal writer of hundreds of ghost stories, sci-fi stories, horror stories, and romance novels. And they kind of took me in, and Heather told me about the Horror Writing Society, and, you know, we traded information. They just met me. We took pictures. It was great. And I also met some of the volunteers for the Greater Los Angeles Writer Society, GLAWS. And they, you know, they told me to come to their meetings, and I said, okay, I'll check it out. And that's kind of how I started in 2008. I went to one meeting and knew that that was the place for me. I met the president and the founder, Tony N. Todaro, and his group was just so instrumental in introducing me to all the tips, the do's, the don'ts, the hows of writing, and also introduced me to some of the most phenomenal literary figures in writing, from you, from Joni Labaki, to Ray Bradbury, rest in peace. You know, when he came to speak to us and he spoke to me personally, to so many people, and it was really instrumental in me learning the process, the business, and the game of writing and what to do. After 2 years, I became vice president. I was such a volunteer, so gung-ho about being at every event that I became the vice president.
That's a great story. And I do have to say about Tony Todaro, he's probably the most dedicated person I've met to really wanting to be able to help the aspiring writer and artist. He's got so many different things going on. He's constantly creating. He's all over the place.
He's the king. He's the king. He's the king cheerleader for aspiring writers.
He certainly is.
If you are just learning to write, you need to join, if you live in Los Angeles, the Greater Los Angeles Writers Society, because they will definitely help you get started and get on a good path like they did for me.
That's great. That's great.
Thanks.
So when you came to my offices in, like I said, I think it was in 2014, you presented an award on behalf of Greater Los Angeles Writers Society. Tony wasn't able to make it, so he asked you to stand in for him. And that was, we were doing a whole thing there. There were several writing organizations that actually recognized Mr. Hubbard for his writing prowess, and I use that term very, intentionally, because there's been so many different writing organizations and other authors, famous authors, who have acknowledged what some of the different levels that he raised the bar to, like the One Story Typewriter in the Sky that we spoke about prior to the interview. It comes up time and time again. It's one of the favorite stories because of. It's a story within a story within a story, almost, depending upon what level of a, whether you're a writer or just a reader, just it speaks different ways to different people based upon their own experience with writing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So now you said you'd read that, you were reading Typewriter in the Sky. Any comments you've got about that? Because we're talking about writing.
One of my buddies, Mike, used to say, I think I paraphrased it and made it into my own, that I read to inhale and I write to exhale. And breathing helps me to create story.
Right.
And I don't, a lot of people get, what is it? I don't even know what it's called now. When you can't write, what is that called?
Writer's block?
Yeah, I've blocked the word block. I don't really get writer's block, and not to, downplay anyone who gets it, but I think partly because when I read, I'm inspired. It just inspires me to write. It wakes up my writing muse. And when I started reading that story, and just the way that, Mike D. Wolf, how he's drawn into this world, I mean, it's just everything that I'm, it's just everything that that kind of excites me. And so I love his writing style. I love L. Ron Hubbard's story and how he became a writer and what he did. You know, I've seen a couple of short films on it. And his style is the kind of style that's, I wouldn't call it purple prose. It's not that, but it's colorful as well as vivid, as well as fun. And it's always, you know, full of adventure, action and adventure. So yeah. I love that style of writing.
Yeah, he was writing at a time when this was the gold, what became the golden age. At the time, it was, he said it was just a lot of intense creativity that was taking place. But he was, you know, America at the time had just gone through World War One, the Depression. Mm-hmm. Half America mm-hmm. was out of work. The other half was uncertain about what was going to happen. World War II was like looming because of all the what was happening in Europe at the time. So people were definitely, you know, uneasy. So they needed something that would be a little bit larger than life, that would, at least for a little bit, their reading, distract them from the worries of what was happening. And so his stories also tend to survive the test of time, because he's more yeah. people-centric, you know?
Yeah.
Because people haven't really changed, you know. A good guy is still a good guy. A gentleman is still a gentleman. A schnook is still a schnook. So, so he's got those characters, and by having it, how he does that with making it so vivid, it
yeah, and know, characters you can relate to.
Exactly,
characters you can relate to. Characters that you people you know.
Yeah,
and I think that's what helps it make the test of time, stand the test of time.
Yeah, because it you know if. You know, he just didn't have that much attention on the technology then as much as it was on the people, and which is why Street and Smith, which was the major publishing house at that time, pulled him in as a very successful adventure writer, and gave him to this new editor, John W. Campbell, for Astounding, and said, okay, we want you to add people to science fiction, so it's not so much the ray gun robot.
Right.
But instead, you know, we got people involved in the genre. He did that also with horror too. Have you ever read Fear?
I have not.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that was also transformative of the horror genre, that introduced kind of like the concept of psychological thrillers, which even Stephen King says this is one of the really, really good ones.
What is it called? Fear?
Fear, yeah.
You have to check that out. Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, just we're talking about Gloss and, you know, what it does to the aspiring writer. That's, we also got to know each other through Writers of the Future. You've been to some of the events and stuff, and that's pretty much the purpose of Writers of the Future
okay,
as well.
Wait, can we just talk about that event?
Okay. Yeah, okay, good.
That event, first of all, and I can get excited very quickly. That event, to me, is like the Oscar Awards of writing. Joni Labaki, let me tell you something. The first time I met Joni Labaki, so after the show, which is this grand show of performances, aerial, there was an aerial, what do you call them? The aerial dancers.
Yeah.
Every show is something different and something grand and something big. Something Vegas-like, you know, and as well as, you know, the award show itself, which is always interesting. After the show, I there's mingling and people are speaking to each other and, you know, getting, you know, seeing each other for the first time in a year. And, you know, I don't know how I met her. But she came up to me and she said, are you Ace Antonio Hall? Or either someone introduced us. And she said, are you Ace Antonio Hall? I said, yes. And she grabbed my hand and said, come on. And she took me all around the place and introduced me to everyone. And then she interviewed me. And from that moment on, I was in love with Writers and Illustrators of the Future. And, you know, whenever she called me or needed me to do something, I was there. And, you know, it's a great event. It's one of the premier events, I believe, especially for aspiring writers, because, you know, I was lucky enough to get an honorable mention recognition on two of my short stories, and that's hard enough. I know of writers that submitted, you know, several times, 7, 8 times before they won. But when you win, it just opens the doors for you in such a way, and more so than many other organizations can do for you. So it's a great organization. And the contestants even have a chance to do workshops with some of the top literary authors in the field. And it's just a wonderful way to get into the writing business.
Yeah, that was conceived originally in 83 by L. Ron Hubbard. When he launched the contest, he had just finished with his release of Battlefield Earth in 82. And so he had had a history already of lending a helping hand to the aspiring writer. And so this was a continuation of that. So when he launched his contest, you know, even many of the original judges said, you know, if this makes it 10 years, that would be great. You know, this is a really noble purpose in what it's doing. But now we are in year 38. And
wow.
It's
38th
year now, and we have entries from over 175 countries. We have thousands of entries each quarter now. It's just mammoth between the writers and illustrators of the feature contest.
And that's excellent. Kudos to you. That's excellent.
It's an amazing program, and it's stayed true to the original intention that Mr. Hubbard created for it, was to provide that means for the aspiring writer artist to be seen and acknowledged. And because it's blind judging, everybody has a fair chance, you know, because all the judges will see is the story or the art and a number. They have no idea of the race, nationality, age, sex, anything. It's just straight, how good is the story? So it's the only thing like that. And it's free to enter. And now we've set it up so you can enter online too. So you'd even have to be able to afford the postage, which the adage about the poor starving artist is so true. So now that they don't have to spend any money to make copies of their art to send it in, we've been able to get so many more entries from all over the world. So so that's way cool on this thing that you're able to attend that one event, and then you've been able to also assist, the Writers of the Future, as you have by, like, I know that GLAWS is definitely promoted and given a voice to Writers of the Future to all the membership, which has been very much appreciated.
Yeah. Those two organizations were just paramount for helping launch my career.
Yeah. So now, at the outset, I mentioned that we were going to, you know, discuss simple tools to promote yourself, and this is one of the things that you used to do as part of GLAWS, you know, as part of that briefings and seminars used to give. So I think I'll just like turn over the microphone to you, and just other than my periodic wows and oohs and ahs, just how does one present themselves? You know, what makes a good bio, and how important is a headshot, and any other points that you've got that's important?
Well, you know, first let me start by saying I completely empathize with most writers. You just want to write. You really don't want to spend a lot of time, almost an oxymoron, online, because of social networking now, people can spend a lot of time online, but you really don't want to spend a lot of time online promoting yourself. You just want to write. And to be frank, that's just not the world we live in anymore. I remember when I had the opportunity to have dinner with Jerry Purnell, rest in peace, Larry Niven, and Robert Sawyer. Jerry Purnell told me this story about how he was just starting, and he did this little book signing in a little small town. And he said, you know, just be humble, just always do as much as you can, you know, even if it's a small, you know, independent bookstore or what have you, you know, just do it, because it all adds to your career. And he did. And he said it was raining all day and no one came. And, you know, he was starting to feel like maybe he made a mistake in doing, you know, in doing the book signing. And this small local television news show showed up, and, you know, they said, hey, we'd like to interview you for our show. And he said, wow, news must be really slow in this town. And he did the interview. And he says now that he goes there, he sells at least a telephone book worth of books, a telephone book of names worth of books. In other words, a metaphor for he sells tons of books. And it was just going to that little small outfit. And it made me understand how branding is everything. Another thing Jerry said was he doesn't talk about himself. Hey, buy this book. This is this. This is that. He talks about things in his life. He doesn't try to sell the book. He just tells you about, what he's doing. And he said that was the best thing because instead of turning people off, you meet people at a lot of events and the first thing, hey, my book is this, my book is that, my book is this. They're just talking about events, things that happen in their life. And that is what makes them more approachable and makes them more likable. So one of the first tools I believe in promoting yourself is understanding, number one, branding is everything. Number two, that the internet is forever. So when you realize that the internet is forever and you're an aspiring writer or an author, and you've got a couple of books out or self-published books out or, traditionally published books out, one of the rules that I have is never argue with anyone because the internet is forever. More and more so you hear about people losing money, losing jobs because of something they did 2 or 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 10 years ago, it surfaces and then they lose, an endorsement or two. It just happened recently to a few Hollywood stars. The internet is forever. Never argue. I try not to never discuss religion, politics, or anything that can be that hot button for negativity.
Yeah.
Because you're an author, you want to sell books and you want to build your brand, you want to build a fan base. Believe me, your fan base has all types of different opinions. And so you just kind of want to stay away from that and just say, hey, this is what I do. So I tell everyone who's promoting themselves, never argue, discuss religion, politics, and social media, nor say anything negative about anyone in the literary industry. Yay, I just got a negative response from, XYZ publishing, and they did this and did that. I stay away from all that. And I tell all, when I do my keynote speaking events, I tell everyone, stay away from any of that. Because you never know how that may come back and bite you. That might be the same organization or publisher that wants to sign you and they realize, oh, you're the one that did that. And, you burned your bridge. So that's number two. The other thing is in promoting yourself, the internet has set it up where for a very small amount of money, you can invest in yourself and expose yourself. For example, on Instagram, you can actually expose yourself to hundreds of new writers per month, per week, per day, depends on how you do it. If you start a business account, if you're a writer and an author, you start a business account. You just have to Google how to start a business account on Instagram and it will show you the prompts and you follow the prompts and you set up a business profile and maybe for $1 a day or $1 a week, you can promote your book and it shows you how you can promote it to different parts of the world and for different people of different interests. It's all set up like that. And now, without really talking to anyone, if you're, an introvert and you really don't like talking to people, all you have to do is put a cover of your book, some information about your book, and do for $1 a day or $1 a week, do a little, a business profile. And now you're exposing yourself to hundreds of people a day, a week. It depends on how much. You can do $1 a day, $2 a day, $5 a day. That might be a bit much, but $5 a week. Whatever it is, for that little small amount of investment, $20 a month, $10 a month, you're now exposing yourself to hundreds of new writers all over the world. How can you beat that? How can you beat that? So I believe those are two of the things that you can do. The other thing is when you query. So I believe that you have to have a very succinct and very efficient query letter when you query literary agents and you query publishers. There are some things you can look it up online. There's many, many resources on how to, the best way to query. And of course, you never answer the rejections. You never answer the rejections, but the best way to query. And there are many ways to do that, but you want to keep it short, really anywhere from a paragraph to two paragraphs, and that's it.
So you can you describe, please, what a query is?
Is basically an introduction letter. Great. Thanks for asking.
Yeah.
A query is basically an introduction letter, and it's saying a few things. It's saying, I have this book that's so many words, 70,000 words, and then you give a little quick elevator pitch of about 1 to 2 sentences of what the book is about. Usually in an elevator pitch, you have to have, I think, about 5 crucial things. Who meaning, who's the protagonist, what the conflict is, where it's happening in a local town, and who the protagonist is, whether the protagonist is a bad guy or nature or whatever the evil spirit, what the protagonist is, and what's at stake. You know, you have those 4 or 5 elements and you have a great elevator pitch. You know, let me try to think of something. When a shark kills people in a local coastal town, a waterphobic sheriff gathers together, a team to find the shark before it kills again. You know, so mm-hmm. I already told you who the antagonist is, who the person is, and I put a little conflict with the actual the protagonist by telling you he's waterphobic. So there's a little bit of the conflict. He has to go in the water, stop the shark. We all know what story I'm talking about, Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
He has to go in the water and stop the shark, but he's water phobic. So there's a little bit of the conflict. I tell you where, a local coastal town. You know, that's telling you where. You don't have to say specifically where. So you have the elevator pitch, 1 to 2 sentences, and then you have how many words it is. You have what genre it's in. And you could add, if you like, maybe what audiences would like this book. Young readers who enjoy, action thrillers, or young readers who enjoy, young adult horror, science fiction and romance. And you have that little bit. And then if you have a little bit of history in that area or awards, you put 2 or 3 of the awards that you have. You know, I won the Bram Stoker Award. I was a two-time honorable mention, I had 2-time honorable mention recognition at the, at the Writers and Illustrators of the Future Awards. You put 1 or 2 of those things, and I've published 3 books, this book, and that book, and that's pretty much it, and that's your query letter. So you query that to the literary agent, maybe a little bit of your background. I have a bachelor's degree in writing, and I graduated from, Stanford University or whatever it may be. And that's pretty much it. So that's your query letter. So you keep your query letter pretty short. And if you get a rejection, I always say no, basically change that in your mind to means not yet, that you're just not ready yet. I submitted, when I first started submitting short stories, I had a goal in mind that I wanted to get it published. So people complain to me sometimes. They come to me and they say, hey, I got rejected 5, 6, 7 times. I can't take this anymore. And when I tell them my story, they continue to submit their stories. I submitted 7 times a day for about 6 months to different publishers. I received 582 rejections. 582 rejections, which is extremely, you want to just go walk off the plank after that. But I received, out of those 582 rejections, also got 18 yeses. 18 yeses. Now you say, oh my God, you published 18 short stories? In a year and a half, 18 of my short stories were published. That's a lot.
It is.
But I went through 582 rejections. So no means not yet. You keep going. So promoting yourself also means not stopping. It could mean you're not ready yet. You keep polishing up your work. You know, I read. I don't know any writer who doesn't read. If you're an author and you're a published author, you must read. You must understand what you're reading, the tropes of your genre. But basically, you know, I don't want to get side note onto that, more to promoting yourself. Also, your bio. So your bio basically very short, 2 or 3 sentences. You want your bio to tell your background, your education, any of the awards you may have that's relevant to the writing career, and that's it. Maybe where you live, of course. You know, I live in Los Angeles, I live in New York, and that's pretty much it. The tone of your bio, if you want to add 1 or 2 little soft things about yourself, can tell what kind of writing you have. So if you write humorous books, so when you say where you live, I live at home with my bonsai tree. You know, that's a little bit of a humor, you know, a little humor added to that. So sometimes the tone of how you describe yourself also shows the genre of your book. And speaking of tone, we go to your picture, your promotional picture. I have seen so many biographical photographs of an author where they just simply went outside and took a picture with their phone and their cat is in the background and you see the garden or something like that. I mean, it's cute, it's a nice little picture, but I don't think that's a promotional picture to brand yourself with. When you look at some of your favorite authors, look in the back of the books at some of the photographs that they have, you know, their bio pictures, their bio photos. If you look at a Stephen King's picture, a lot of them look really, the tone of it looks really dark. There's a reason for that. That's what he writes. He writes horror. You know, you look at the picture and it's the shadows in the picture or his expression. It looks dark, you know. So you also kind of want to try to create a tone for your photograph. But most importantly, you want to have a professional photograph. Today, you can pretty much shoot a professional photograph, you know, and use filters and have a background. You just want to have a solid background behind you of black or white or red or pink. You have a solid background behind you and it's just a head shot, just your head. And you can now use filters to have the lighting look perfect and take out the wrinkles or whatever you want. And you have a nice little shot. I prefer using a professional photographer. Now you can get a professional photographer for anywhere from $50 to $100. And you have your headshots. So I believe when you present yourself with professional headshots, this is branding yourself as someone who a publisher says, I can invest my money into this author, you know, and feel good that we're going to make money off of them. Because that's all they want to do. They love the story, but they want to profit off of your story. So you want to make sure that as an author, you're also a business. So being a business, you know, one, branding is everything. 2, the internet is forever. Don't argue with people. You know, stay positive. 3, you can invest in yourself for $1 a week, $1 a day. You know, you can invest in yourself on some of the websites like Instagram or Facebook. And then 4, make sure you have a great bio, a short bio, a succinct bio, and a great photo of yourself. So I think those are some of the simple tools to promote yourself.
Wow, that's really good. And it's interesting, you know, one thing I want to go back to when you were talking about the number of rejects that you had. Another thing too that a person doesn't normally think of, they'll think, oh, wow, this is the best story I've ever written, and it comes back rejected. They don't know that on the other end, the editor looking at it or the first read or whatever has just had 10 more stories just like that. Or the magazine, had just sold that same type of story in the last issue, so they're not going to do it for another 6 issues.
Right.
So it could be that too, or it could be something as simple as just a bad hair day for the editor. He's just like had a fight with his partner, or at work, or you know, just had some disaster befall him, and so he's just got a foul mood, and so. Because yours wasn't a foul story, it was too uplifting for him. He wasn't ready for something like that, so it's like, bah, and so he gets rejected.
John, no means not yet.
Exactly.
It's not yet. Yet is hope. Yet means that you are going to sell it. Yet means, yes, someone will love it. All you need is one. All you need is one person to say yes, just one.
Yeah, yeah. So on on these points, because these are really, really good points.
Thanks.
On the aspect of the internet is forever, because this is something that gets violated, and I see this violated quite routinely where, especially now with the, you know, even in the Me Too movement, where it gets, people are really take sides. And yep. I've kept a thing very, very clear on Writers of the Future. I don't take sides. I'm not anything about religion. I'm not anything about politics. It's all mm-hmm. about the author and writing. And I definitely don't go after dissing some other author for whatever reason. You know, it's just,
right.
They're a fellow creative. And I've had it before with a contest where some people have just, you know, they obviously weren't raised to learn about manners. You know, they just like seem to get very rude. And so I don't get it. I won't engage in that. You know, I keep it on that. And if someone's going to have that negativity, that has nothing to do with Writers of the Future. So I just don't allow that.
And I believe, like, if you look at it this way, as regards to dissing another author, or a project. To me, you know, if you're a true artist, you have to respect the art. And respecting the art means to recognize how beautiful it is that no matter who you are, how old you are, where you are, how you look, if you have the magic, you know, it can influence the world. So, you know, somebody may say, hey, I don't like, you know, Sharknado films. Well, you know what? A lot of people like Sharknado films.
Yeah.
And they're making a lot of money. They're on the fifth, sixth, seventh one. People have Sharknado parties. There was a magic to that. There was a magic to that. And to understand and to love the fact that you may not like it doesn't mean that it doesn't have that magic. Let's not even be subjective and say it was good or bad, that it didn't have that magic, okay? It has nothing, you know, if you realize that, you can appreciate someone's art that got out there and that was, you know, that people responded to without saying something negative, like, why did this person win this award? Or why did this person write this book? It's the worst book I've ever read. You don't even go into that. You just respect the art and you respect the artist. And by doing that, that also helps you brand yourself.
Yeah. And perhaps you're talking about having the business account, you know, if you're going to have something where you just can't, you feel like you can't live if you have to constantly be muzzled, then have a second private account that you can do where you can do your stuff. But I absolutely agree that from the public view, you know, you can feel as impassioned as you want to about some political or religious wrong. And just realize, go back 10 years, how things have changed and evolved, and the pendulum moves back and forth. And it's, like you said, the internet's forever. So people go, oh, look, you said 8 years ago, you said blah, when it was the thing to say, but now it's just the opposite. And now you're going to be caught in this web of pushback on you. And it's just not worth it.
If you're really worried, the key word you just said was evolve. I think you said evolve.
Yeah.
Things evolve. And when you understand that things evolve, your position as well could evolve. And who you were 10 years ago is not the same person. But if you say that 10 years ago, it can definitely affect your career in a negative way.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, but it's true.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just unfortunate. So on the subject then of writing, any particular other, because this has been very, very good what you covered, and I've not really addressed this before. Any other tips you've got for the aspiring writer? And I don't know, I guess this would also apply to the artist as well. Not I guess, it definitely applies to the artist as well, the illustrator, on getting themselves known. Any other things that you routinely get asked or go over when you do your keynotes?
Let's see. So there are two things. One is, for example, if you're in the California area, Los Angeles area, and you're just starting writing, you know, you would join a group called, you know, GLOSS. Why? Okay, this is how GLOSS helped me. That particular not to just pound in your, you know, pound on, you know, pound in your mind, get join laws, but that particular society, they would go to writing conventions every single month. So here's a tip. You join a writing organization, whether it's in Ohio, Florida, wherever it is, and you volunteer. When you volunteer, you get a chance to go to these, well, at least with our particular organization, you go to these events free. So when you go to an event like the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, where 18, 20,000 people, you are now able to interact with all of these people who could be your potential fans and your potential mentors. It's a wonderful way to interact with them. And part of my path and my growth in the literary industry was getting to know people over the years, being to those events over and over, seeing them over and over and over again at West Hollywood Book Fair, at the, you know, at the at Comic Con or at the WonderCon. WonderCon we used to do a lot, and see them over and over again and talk to them and sometimes sit down at lunch with them. You know, that whole process not only gave me the knowledge and the how-to about writing books, and you know, but it also just it helped me develop relationships, which is so key in this industry, developing relationships. So the tip I would have is join a writer's group, a writer's society. If you're already a published author and you're not just an aspiring author, you've been out there, maybe you were lucky enough right on your first book to have a New York Times bestseller. Then you join organizations that have been longstanding, that are prestigious, like a Horror Writers Association, which is worldwide, you know. And that organization can also help propel and launch you into the higher level or the next level of your career. And then the other thing is, you know, in some of the writing societies, they have what you call writers groups or critique groups. That helped me. When I first started the Greater Los Angeles Writers Society, you know, I joined a critique group. And the critique group allowed me to get instantaneous, very quick, you know, reactions to my writing, because we would submit a chapter or submit, you know, two chapters or 20 pages or 25 pages, and everyone in that group would be able to respond. As a new writer, it was great to be able to see 10, 12 different people, you know, opinions of my writing. Warning, warning, warning. This is the warning. You know, sometimes that can turn you off. But the thing Tony and Todaro used to always say is, if 10 people say this about your writing, maybe they have a thing. Maybe, you know, maybe they're saying something that's important. Doesn't mean change it, but it does mean to look at it and maybe improve upon it or polish it. Not just, you know, necessarily go on what someone says. But I had very good experiences with my writing group. I do know people who had bad experiences with critique groups. So I do say, do your research. And do your research well and find out if it's a reputable critique group that you join. Who are the people in the group? Do they have published work? Do they have self-published work? You know, are they serious about their writing, or have they just been doing it for 15 years and no one's put out a book? So you do your research on that. But if you can get with a good critique group, it can really help launch your career. Because in my critique group, I had a guy that helped start me out. He basically did my editing for me for free for my first book. So I actually had a professional editor, which is, could be worth anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000, $1,500. You know, I had for free that went over and did a substantive editing of my book, and it helped me get it really polished so I could submit it to the publishers. So, you know, I think those are the great tips. Join a writing group or join a critique group, and that will help kind of further and get your, you know, get your feet into, you know, get your feet solid into, you know, into the foundation of your career of writing.
That's awesome. Thank you so very much. Yeah, thank you very much. Now, last thing that I need to make sure everybody knows is branding. So how do people find Nzondi?
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, simply, you know, if you Google Ace Antonio Hall, you know, if you Google that, then all the stuff comes up. Or if you Google N-Z-O-N-D-I, you know, a lot of the stuff comes up. But there are also African, a lot of people in Africa with the name Nzondi. So it may be very unique here in America, but it's a popular name in Africa.
Paul.
But, you know, You know, my book is called Owari Mosaic, O-W-A-R-E. It kind of is pronounced like O-H-W-A-R-E-E-E, Owari Mosaic. And you can Google that. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter as @Nzondi3. I'm on Facebook as Ace Antonio Hall in parentheses Nzondi. So you can definitely Google that. I've been lucky enough. A lot of things that I've written and posted have been quoted and requoted. If you put in Ace Antonio Hall quotes, you will find a flurry of different websites that have loved my quotes and put them in different pictures and, you know, have cited my quotes. So those are some of the ways that you can find me and my upcoming. And you can also look at some of the publishers. My first publisher was Montag Press, M-O-N-T-A-G Press Collective. Or the publisher that I've done three or four books with, Omnium Gatherum, O-M-N-I-U-M, Gatherum, G-A-T-H-E-R-U-M Media. And they're actually doing my next book, which is called Lipstick Asylum. That will be coming out in the fall of this year, September 2021.
That's great. And absolutely, anybody listening to this, take a look at any of these social pages. He's got such a cool headshot. You know, he's like, he practices what he preaches. So that's really awesome.
I appreciate it. Thanks, John.
Yes. Well, thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. We've also been syndicated on the United Public Radio Network, where you can find these podcasts as well by just typing in Writers of the Future. Again, I highly recommend you read the Writers of the Future series. These are, after all, who our judges have selected as the best of the best new writers and artists. They can be found at writersofthefuture.com, at Amazon, or wherever you get your books. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, Nzondi.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast. Thanks a lot, John.